Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is William Jones. I'm an attorney at Moy White. My registration number is 35294. I'm here today representing the appellants, John McNutt, Timothy McNutt, and Christopher Forrest in this case. We're here today on the merits aspect of this appeal because the trial court's refusal to apply the economic loss rule to the situation for which the economic loss rule is designed, namely a party suing in tort for breaches of a contractual obligation. The particular scenario, as I know you are aware, is the sale of a residential home. My clients, I'll refer to collectively as the sellers because that's who they were. The buyers were Ms. Gaddis and her husband, both of whom has passed, and the present party is the personal representative for Ms. Gaddis. This is a situation where the parties entered into the relatively standard written form real estate contract. As part of that contract, there was a requirement on my clients as the sellers to produce a SPD, a seller property disclosure list, by a certain date. That document was produced. That document was executed by both the sellers and the buyers. And by the terms of the contract itself, that disclosure was expressly incorporated within the contract between the parties for the sale of a home. The property disclosure was acknowledged and executed by the buyers as they received it in the process of moving from the contract to the closing, as happens in all residential sales in the state. Based on claims of non-disclosure, there were three claims asserted at the trial level against my clients, all three of which were torts: negligent misrepresentation, intentional or reckless misrepresentation, and finally a tort of omission. Following the trial, my clients prevailed on two of those three tort claims, the negligent and the intentional misrepresentation claims. The judgment was entered against them on the one claim, the tort claim of omission. The issue of the economic loss rule was raised at the trial level, and the trial court should have applied it to dismiss the tort claim. And the reason for that is the economic loss rule, as designed, is to bound to police the boundary between contract and tort. The famous phrase is that without the economic loss rule, contract drowns in a sea of tort because every breach of a contractual obligation can become a tort suit. So because of that, the economic loss rule is set up such that contractual obligations that are set forth by the parties in their contract, if there's a breach of those obligations, the remedy for that, the claim, is for breach of contract and not for tort.
One of the non-disclosures on which the court made a specific finding was your client's failure to disclose if they were principals of the company that did the repair work. That wasn't in the SPD. So couldn't Mrs. Gaddis have prevailed wholly apart from the alleged non-disclosures of matters that were set forth in the SPD?
I think the answer to that is no, and here's why. The SPD is a form, and you'll note if you look at it, is not a complete document in the sense that after each and every section within the SPD, the blanks under section A, B, C, all the way through F. The reason for that is that the SPD is intended to, it is used as, the spot for which disclosures must be made about the property. If there are additional matters that aren't specifically mentioned therein that are material and need to be disclosed, that's your moment to do it, and that's there's a place in the form for that.
Is there an instruction on the form that obligates the seller to disclose information other than as set forth in the particular questions that are asked?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe the instructions on the form itself about the making disclosures about the property and also about the legal liability that attaches to that encompasses that obligation. The other thing I would note about that particular aspect of the case in answer to your earlier question is that that aspect of the trial judge's ruling, albeit I think if you read his ruling less important than the others, it was a straight omission, okay? So the fact is, when you have an SPD and something should have been on it and isn't, it's not as if you would find a line that says, "Are you the, are you an owner of a construction company that may have done some work on this property?" Because of the nature of it as an omission, rather than, for example, the expansive soils, which was another aspect referred to by the trial judge, I think those things taken together show that the SPD is intended to be the repository of disclosures related to the property, both what's specifically on there and also with regard to any other matters that are material on the property. And that's why, that's what.
I'm sorry, I just want to, I want to clarify this for one moment. The relationship of the constructor, that's really not related to the property though. So how would that ever be encompassed within the property disclosure form?
Well, as I read the trial court's finding, the trial court found there were three things mentioned as the basis for the omission claim. The statement that they had no knowledge of property, the statement with regard to the expanse of soils, and then there was a reference in the beginning of that section to a failure to disclose the ownership interest in the entity. The form itself is designed in such a way that if that is material, and that may or may not be material based on specific facts, specific property relationships of the parties, there's an opportunity there with those blanks and within the context of those disclosures to disclose that or any other items which might be material to a particular sale. If you're a seller of property and you want to do as these parties did and have a contract where you can make disclosures and have certainty in conducting yourself in the transaction, you can choose, as they did, to use this form incorporated in the contract and use that to encompass those disclosures obligations within there. If the law were otherwise, as argued by my opponents, the property disclosure is essentially a nullity. I mean, it covers only certain items. It has changed over time as the form has evolved to cover whatever issues that the real estate board and those who create these forms feel are important. But without that, you as a seller would be have your express disclosure obligations which are in the contract, and then also have additional amorphous and essentially undefined obligations outside of that. The reality of that would be that you're in a situation where you are liable to be sued in tort arising out of these contractual obligations which are contained in the SPD and the contract.
So it's your contention there was no independent duty to disclose anything about the expanse of soils or anything known to the sellers but unknown to the buyers?
No, the duty exists when the parties chose here through the SPD and the contract to incorporate that obligation within their contractual relationship. And I think the Hayman Constructors case is instructive on this point in that the economic loss rule cover situations where there is an independent duty, so the parties choose to incorporate that within their contract, it becomes a contractual obligation is subject to the rule.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Jones, but in that context, would you please address whether you think that Mid Valley applies or does not apply?
In Mid Valley, just is the earlier case, the case that was cited in the supplemental authority, I believe?
Yes, it's comparatively recent.
I think that case doesn't apply to the issue the court's faced with here, and it's essentially for this reason. If I recall Mid Valley correctly, when I read through it, that was an issue as to whether or not a bank which had foreclosed and obtained the property was a homeowner, such that the exception to the economic loss rule for defective construction claims in building a residential property applies. The reason I think it doesn't apply is because this is not a case that involved any claim of defective construction. This was a straight buyer and seller misrepresentation claim. So I think in that case, it doesn't apply in the exception therein to the economic loss rule, which has been there since the adoption of the rule here in Colorado, is that when there is a construction defects, you build something and didn't do a good job of building it in a residential setting, tort and negligence claims remain available regardless of the contract between the parties for the construction. I don't think that applies here because we're not talking about a construction contract or any proof or allegations of that in this case. This was a buyer and a seller selling property without that construction angle.
Take issue with that. I mean, your clients, through an entity, performed $100,000 or more of repairs on the house. Why is that a meaningful difference between a latent defect that inherited in that process and a latent defect that inherited in an original construction?
There are two distinctions here which are important. The first distinction is the construction work itself was not performed on my clients, it was performed by an entity which was not a party herein. So to the extent they wanted to make that.
Did your clients control that entity?
Well, my clients had an membership interest in it. I mean, if they wanted to impose control liability on my clients for the actions of their construction, they have to jump through the legal hoops to do that. None of that occurred in this case. The second distinction, which I think is important, is that there are substantively different rules that apply to that, one of which is particularly applicable in this case is the statute of repose. I mean, this is a case with a sale that occurred in 2003 and a lawsuit that didn't begin until, I believe, 2010, although it may be later. Because of that, to the extent the plaintiffs wanted to assert a construction claim against the party that allegedly did negligent construction on the property, they certainly had an opportunity to do so, but here the statute of repose had kicked in, such that my understanding is they would have been barred by that. Of course, they didn't bring that claim, but had they brought that claim, they would have been barred. And in that scenario, I think it's particularly important to uphold the economic loss rule here. If the parties wanted to assert a defective construction claim against the party that did construction on a residence, they were free to do so. They did not. They shouldn't be allowed to do an end around of that by naming the individuals who had an ownership interest in that entity and charging them as sellers and then suing them in tort for a breach of the contractual disclosure obligation, which was included in the contract. So I think that's two substantive distinctions between that, Your Honor, and the present case. And if I may, I was planning on reserving the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Goddard, the law firm of Hassler, Von Bahr & Goddard. My co-counsel, Mr. James Bramer, is with me. So the law firm is Swift & Bramer. My registration number is 17645. I want to make a few brief comments, and then I want to get into what I really believe are the substantive issues and my request for the oral argument is the source of duty, and is the common law duty replicated in the contract? And that's where I want to spend the majority of my time. Just a few brief observations in reference to what Judge Dunn asked. This case is a situation, much like Mid-Valley, where you have a common law, well-recognized, independent duty of care. It's been recognized in Colorado for 50 years. Now, the significance of that is the AC Excavating Beef Yacht Club case, which Judge Webb addressed in the Mid-Valley decision. And there's some language in there, in that AC Excavating from the Supreme Court. They say, where there exists a duty of care independent of any contractual obligations, the economic loss rule has no application and does not bar a plaintiff's tort claim because the claim is based on a recognized independent duty of care and thus falls outside the scope of the economic loss rule. And Judge Menard, you addressed that in your case, I believe, cited in the supplemental decision.
Casey.
I don't have it right hand with me. I'll get to it in a second.
That's the Casey case.
Thank you. So that's the first just observation I'd like to make. The second one is, as I said, this duty is one that has been announced in prior case law, and we discussed that in our answer brief at 18 through 20. Now, I find it very interesting that in the entire opening brief, there is no mention of the independent duty of care that exists by common law. Matter of fact, the opening brief goes as far as to say, disregard it. It doesn't matter that we have an independent duty of care here. I disagree. That is the heart of the economic loss rule. When you have that independent duty of care, the economic loss rule does not apply. And I will get into whether or not it's replicated in the contract in a second. The next point, or just observation, is the breach of that duty, that common law duty of non-disclosure, is not an issue. They don't contest that they didn't breach that duty of care. The trial court found it. We put in our answer brief all the trial court's findings relating to that. It's undisputed that the sellers breached the common law duty of care of non-disclosure. It's undisputed the amount of damages that were awarded by the trial court. Those issues aren't even raised. Now, I want to address real quick the issue, and Judge Webb, you did address this issue in the Valley, is just because you have a contract does not conclude that the economic loss rule applies. It does not apply to every contractual situation. The trial court addressed that in its order denying the motion for summary judgment on the economic loss rule. Judge Webb, you addressed that same issue or commented on it in Mid-Valley. The final point I want to make, or observation, is because of the nature of what we're dealing with here, a seller's property disclosure in a real estate transaction, it's very similar to fraud in the inducement. Because the significance is not the entering into the contract. The significance is the purchase of the property.
Didn't the trial court expressly reject the fraud in the inducement analysis?
At the bill of cost hearing, he did.
Okay.
And I mention that because of the Tenth Circuit decision in United Intern Holdings. And they specifically said in that case, in a similar situation, that you don't just breach a contract when you cause someone to buy property knowing that it has faults and you don't disclose those faults. You're committing fraud. You're not just breaching a contract. Now I want to get to what I think are the significant ones. Are the source of the duty, and I'll just touch on that, and then is the contract, is there a common law duty replicated in the contract? Source of the duty is obviously very important. It's the key to determine the availability of a contract, or the Hammond decision, quoting from Town of Alma, says the key to determine the availability of a contract or tort action lies in determining the source of the duty that forms the basis of the action. Here, that source of duty is the common law non-disclosure duty of care. So the source of duty arises from common law. So that leaves us with the one issue, and that is, if an independent duty of care does exist, which it does in this case, then the economic loss rule cannot apply unless the duty imposed in the contract is the same as the common law duty. At least that's how I read BRW Inc. And the other cases that have relied upon that decision.
Okay, well, why is your opponent incorrect that the purpose of and intent of the SPD was to circumscribe all of a seller's disclosure duties as they relate to the property?
And that brings me to my next point. Critical difference in our positions. The sellers argue that the SPD is a contract and creates contractual obligations that replace the common law duty of care. Now, certainly the contract at Section 10 requires completion of the SPD, but it does not limit the common law duty. Instead, it assumes that common law duty remains. But we called at trial Mr. Ryan, who was the president or the chairman of the forms committee for the SPD and the form contract, and has been for years. And we did to explain what the role of the SPD is. And we provided several quotes in our answer brief from Mr. Levine. He said, the law requires adverse material information to be disclosed. The method of getting that disclosure is not prescribed. The SPD was not intended to create a contractual obligation or to be part of the terms of the contract. Rather, it is a vehicle to assist a seller to make disclosures to a buyer of adverse material facts relative to the property. It assists a seller in fulfilling the duty by identifying common conditions which, if present, should be disclosed. As such, it is independent of the contract. Mr. Levine further said, if a seller has knowledge of adverse material facts and those are not enumerated in the form, the seller is still obligated to make that disclosure.
Typically, we would interpret a contract within its four corners unless we found it to be ambiguous. In light of that rule, what's the legal significance of Mr. Levine's testimony about what he thinks the contract means?
Well, if you were to interpret the four corners of the document and you looked at that seller's property disclosure, what you're going to see at the very end, and the trial court, I think, mentioned as well, is you've got this big, in bold letters at the bottom of this document, the SPD, advisory to seller. Failure to disclose a known material defect may result in legal liability. That refers back, as Mr. Levine said, to that common law duty of care. What the SPD is a means of providing evidence by the seller that they have disclosed certain information concerning the property. It provides that written evidence. That's all it does. If you look at it itself, four corners of the contract, like you said. And let me jump forward to that point. If you look at it itself, there are no parties to that document. It says that the seller is filling this out possibly for prospective parties. It's in the very beginning of it. You look at the signature lines. All that the buyer is signing on and signing on the SPD is acknowledgement that they received it. There are no obligations in it. There are no contractual terms. All it is the contract says, you provide the disclosures, that provides evidence that these particular questions were answered by the seller. Now that brings us to the question again. If this is a contract, then what does that do to the law of non-disclosure, especially in the real estate context? What it does is it says, and this is where we got in, this is where we got into a trial as well, is I only have to disclose what's in the disclosures. I have no obligation to tell you anything unless you ask me. I have no obligation to tell you anything unless it's specifically stated in the disclosures. Now you get into this issue of my understanding of the questions that are asked of me on part of the seller, the buyer's interpretation of those responses they're receiving, and then you get into the question of, is then the disclosure limited just to the information provided, or is there other information that's not provided that's just as material, like the, in this case, the engineering reports, the relationship of the sellers to the people who did the who performed the repairs? That's not on the disclosure. So does that mean no obligation to disclose? That is why you cannot put contract law into the SPD, because it was never designed to do that. What it would do is turn the whole transaction into a game of 20 questions. If the buyer doesn't ask it, I don't have to respond. That's why it doesn't work. Matter of fact, I'll give you a perfect example of why it won't work, why it couldn't be breach of contract. Suppose that the buyer makes a misrepresentation on the SPD. Seller knows it's a misrepresentation. They know the true condition of the property. But it's still, nevertheless, a breach of that SPD if it's a breach of contract. Buyer buys the property knowing the true condition. Can the buyer sue because of that condition? No, because they had knowledge of that condition. And what that's called in tort law is reliance. It has a requirement of reliance. It's not the breach, it's the sale of the property not disclosing a adverse material fact. And that is why we sued in tort. And that is why for 50 years the law has been that a seller has an obligation to disclose adverse material facts. And to try to put that into a list of 20 questions will not work. It should remain with the common law duty of care, just like AC Excavating. They said, we're going to hang on to that common law duty of care with regard to residential construction, just as you dealt with in the Mid Valley case, Judge Webb. You need to hang on to that duty of care in the area of disclosure, because if it gets jettisoned from that, then you fundamentally change that relationship between the buyer and the seller. Because remember, that duty of care is based not upon contracts. You'll never, even though all property is purchased under a contract, you won't find any reference to contracts in any of those cases that adopted that duty of care. It's based upon the superior knowledge of the seller. And it's not fair to allow that buyer to sell that property having that superior knowledge, knowing of the defect, and not disclosing it to the buyer.
Counsel, you're not saying, are you? I understand that you're saying that this particular form does not feed the bulldog in this case. But you're not saying that it would be impossible to draft a contract between the parties that would adequately incorporate the common law duty, are you?
I am not. And that's where I think that's where the law would go, and that's where attorneys would go. And that's sort of like the former TCHR case. I would agree that if you had a provision there that says you're not relying on any representations that I made. You're not, you're making your own investigations. You agree that I disclose the following, and that is sufficient. If that's all laid out between two contracting parties, I can understand that. And I understand why former TCRHR is decided the way it is. It's a commercial contract situation where you have that type of release language. You don't have that here. And if that kind of decision is going to be made, it should be made by the Forms Committee. If they want to change that contract, and what attorneys would do is simply say just exactly what you said, Bernard. They would simply say is, buyer, you have an obligation to disclose everything that the common law requires you to disclose. They would just flat out incorporate that common law duty of care right into the contract. And then they would put in the remedies for that breach of that duty of care. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is a form contract that does not include that type of representation that I'm buying the property knowing of the defects, or I am not relying upon anything. To the contrary, as Mr. Line testified, you have situations where the contract is drafted relying upon that duty of care being in existence. And for that reason, because we have an independent duty of care, we have a situation where the common law duty is not replicated in the contract. That means the economic loss rule does not apply. And for that reason, we've asked that you affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you very much.
Let me start by noting that the argument from my opponent seems to presuppose that the disclosure duty somehow disappears and a poor buyer has no remedy. I think it's important to point out, we're not saying that there's no remedy for a buyer, but the remedy is a claim for breach of contract, not a claim for a tort. The remedy is still there, the legal avenue is still available, it's a matter of how you go about it.
Well,
and how you go about it, I'm sorry.
But doesn't that assume that the contract and the common law duty are coterminous?
Yeah, it does, and I would draw some attention to the language in the seller's advisory. We talked about whether that duty was incorporated in the SPD. It says in full, failure to disclose a known material defect may result in legal liability. As I understand it, Ernst, that is the common law. Is that if you fail to disclose a known material defect in the property, you're liable.
You obviously have the form at hand. Is there anything in it that obligates the seller to provide information other than in response to the specific questions?
It notes that it should be completed by the seller. It also notes that the disclosure should be correct to the best of the current actual knowledge. And again, I would note that although in the form of a checklist, it is not complete. In each of the sections, there are blank sections, which I think in any form like this presupposes the ability and, in fact, invites the ability to add additional.
But there is documents. There is no such instruction to provide additional information.
Well, nor is there any instruction that says this is only limited and you can have liability outside the contract for matters that aren't specifically stated herein. I think on that issue, it's silent. I would point the court again to the incorporation of the common law standard there that I read a moment ago at the end, right before the seller's signature spot, which incorporates it by saying known material defect. And the seller, and I think that's the point where it's incorporated.
Let me ask you a completely different question.
Yes, Sean.
The Mid-Valley case, as well as its predecessors, could be interpreted as drawing a bright line between commercial projects and residential projects. If you agree with that, why shouldn't we extend it to protecting a buyer's interest in the family home, as it were, for purposes of fraud, no less than our Supreme Court has chosen to protect it for purposes of negligent construction? Just as a policy.
I think as a policy matter, I think the applicable distinction for a policy matter that should be drawn is the difference between construction and sale. I think that that's the distinction that's there. I think as a policy matter, extending it by carving out this area of the law from the economic loss rule for a residential setting, I think that's a that's a less than optimal policy choice. And the reason for that is that there really isn't any reason in a residential versus a commercial setting to have a different set of obligations that apply to buyer and seller with regard to these things.
Well, isn't one difference that the vast majority of commercial transactions are going to be individually negotiated with through council, while as the vast majority of residential sales are on form contracts, many times without legal representation?
I think that's true. I think the issue, though, relates to the fact that I don't think the line between, you know, residential and commercial is necessarily as clear. If you worry about sophistication of parties and things like that, as we've learned in the latest downturn and in some of the decisions on this, you know, sometimes the homeowner is a very large bank out of Atlanta. And I think, again, drawing a distinction based on the type of the property ignores that economic reality. And the other issue, I think, is that this is a common transaction. I think making a carve-out for the economic loss rule here will have a subsidiary impact. If you're a seller of residential property and you want to incorporate your obligations into this form and you fill it out fully and truthfully, I think you should be able to protect yourself in that way as other contracting parties, both sophisticated and unsophisticated in residential and commercial settings. Yeah, that's the whole point of contract, is being able to negotiate for and allocate your risks and obligations in the way you choose so that you can have certainty in contracting.
Okay, but is there any indication that such negotiations occurred in this case as opposed to the parties just filling out a blanks form?
Well, Your Honor, I think as in any real estate transaction, there was certainly negotiation providing points. Was there specific negotiation over the SPD? I don't think the record shows one way or the other.
Well, is there any evidence in the record that the parties deviated from the standard form contract by amending it as opposed to filling in transaction-specific information in the blanks?
Your Honor, it is my memory in going through there that there were some...
Okay, well, we can look.
I would defer to the contents of the contract, Your Honor.
May I ask one question?
Certainly.
On the disclosure form, the only reason the buyer signs it is to say that the buyer has received it, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it's to acknowledge that it's been received by the buyer pursuant to the contractual obligation to supply the document.
But that's why the buyer's signature is on here, to say we got it, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's why it's on there. It's not there to... Again, that goes into the inspection issues and things like that. It's certainly not on there to acknowledge that they've investigated these things. That occurs later in the process prior to closing.
All right. I appreciate your patience in answering our questions beyond your time. If you want to take a minute and reorganize your materials, we're prepared then to go ahead and hear argument as to which you are again the appellant on the attorney fees award in the trial court, and the appellees have requested attorney fees from this court on essentially the same basis, so you may wish to address that as well.
Thank you, Your Honor, and it's okay. I think I will dive right in.
And the bailiff has reset the clock for 15 minutes for this.
With regard to the attorney fee issue, which is interrelated but somewhat separate, the trial court, following the judgment against my clients on the permission tort, heard argument and awarded attorney's fees against my clients, holding that although my clients had prevailed in two rather than one claim, that Ms. Gaddis had prevailed on the central claim and was thus the prevailing party, and attorney's fees were awarded. The basis for that was the contractual term, the prevailing party provision that was in the contract itself. And our challenge to that turns on several avenues. The first relates back to the argument we just completed, which is obviously would occur to do what we would prefer to do and reverse the judgment. Under those circumstances, Ms. Gaddis would no longer be the prevailing party, and there would be no basis for attorney's fees. The second aspect that we pointed out, which again is somewhat interrelated with the merits, is it is a bit disingenuous, as we argue, for Ms. Gaddis to argue as strenuously as she did that the contract and contractual obligations have nothing whatsoever to do with her tort claim, while at the same time turning around and saying, yes, but I am entitled to my attorney's fees based on the contract itself.
Isn't that position consistent with several opinions from divisions of this court that give very broad interpretation to phrases like relating to and arising from?
I think it's consistent in the sense that there's precedent from this court about relating to and arising from, which interprets that language broadly.
You wouldn't quarrel that this transaction relates to or arises from the contract?
Well, it relates to the purchase of the real estate, absolutely. I think the issue, though, we have is that in the context here, with the economic loss rule aspect, which we've addressed on the merits there, we think that changes the calculus significantly in that for a party to claim no obligation under the contract and then rely on the contract for attorney's fees is contradictory. And we thought that was important as much for the merits consideration as for the attorney's fees. I think thirdly, there was an error that the court made in interpreting the contract itself, and we've tried to set this out within our briefing. When interpreting a contract, as the court well knows, the law favors doing it in such a way that its terms are harmonious and make sense and work as a unified whole, rather than picking up bits here and bits there to look at. When you look at the structure of the contract itself, the attorney fee provision is one of three separate subsections, which are separately delineated within the contract. The original preface to that those three subsections especially relates to a default, meaning a default under the contract or the contractual obligation, which is a specific reference to a payment default in various guises, and also to a default under an obligation of the contract. You know, we believe when reading the contract as a whole, that prefatory language, as most language of its type, necessarily describes all of the subsections which fall underneath it. We also believe that all three subsections should be read with equal dignity. The first, one of the subsections talks about what happens if the buyer defaults on either a payment obligation or contractual obligation. The second talks about what the remedies are if the seller defaults, again, under the contract. And then you come to the third subsection, which talks about the prevailing provision attorney's fees. And we think when you read those the language in the contract together in that sense, it's clear that in this particular language, the attorney's fee award is limited to those situations where there's a breach of a contractual obligation or a payment default. I think we all agree there was not a payment default in this case, so that leaves us with a breach of the contractual obligation. If, in fact, the award that remains here against my clients for the tort of omission, that would necessarily not be a breach of the contractual obligation due to the economic loss rule. And in that scenario, when you read again the attorney fee provision in the context of its section and with its subsections, we believe it should be read fairly to limit an award of attorney's fees solely to those situations where there's a finding of a contractual breach. And that the reading urged on the court and urged on the trial court, which was ultimately adopted, which again talks about the breadth of arising from or relating to another case law, is insufficient within the context of the full section here. In particular, what that does is it takes the attorney fee provision and essentially segregates it from its adjoining sections within the contract. It separates it from the prefatory language in the initial part of the section and essentially looks at it in a void. We believe it's the court's obligation in applying and looking at this contract to read it as a whole in a way that all of its provisions make sense and work in an interactive fashion. Those were the issues that we raised with respect to the attorney's fees, and based on that, we certainly would ask this court to reverse the trial court's award. We also think similarly that would apply to any request for attorney's fees for the appellate portion, which again relates to defending a tort judgment when the contract itself is laid out in such a way that the attorney's fee provision relates solely to the a breach of a contractual obligation, either a payment default or a breach of a contractual obligation is expressly set forth in that portion of the contract.
Let's assume, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, that we rule against you on economic loss and on your interpretation of the attorney fee clause. Under that scenario, is there any reason why the appellees wouldn't get appellate fees as well?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With regard to the issue of costs, I think it's important to note that there's no issue on the reasonableness of the costs or fees. That's not been disputed. And there's no issue that Ms. Gaddis was a prevailing party unless there was a reversal of the underlying case. The issue is, you have a breach of a duty that exists independent of the contract, is not created by the contract, and is not the same as the contractual duty. Can that still nevertheless be related to the contract? The trial court said yes. And I'm going to, I will address the contractual issue, but before I address that, the contextual issue, I want to first address that issue, the issue of can it be related to the contract? And that comes down to the understanding of the clause that's in 20C of the contract. Any event of any arbitration or litigation relating to this contract, the arbitrator or court shall award to the prevailing party all reasonable costs and expenses, including attorney fees. And we've cited in our brief the cases that interpret relating to and arising from. We also cited the U.S. Fidelity and Guarantee Company case that says that each word in an instrument is to be given meaning and if all possible. So if you're going to give meaning to the words relating to the contract, then it cannot be just limited to a breach of contract, because you wouldn't have the words relating to. It would just simply read, any event of any arbitration or litigation, the arbitrator court shall award to the prevailing party all reasonable costs and expenses. Relating to the contract is a very broad term, and it's put in there because the drafter intended that to be broader than a breach of contract issue. And you can see that as interpreted by other divisions of this court in the Meadow Homes Development Court case that we cited in our brief at 12, that says relating to is said to be very broad and covers not simply actions to enforce the agreement, but also actions relating to the agreement. Howe v. Downey, it said we agree with the plaintiffs that lie the broadly word phrase any litigation relating to this contract, the provision would apply to the litigation between the contracting parties concerning a breach of the lease of a different document, a breach of a different document. Robert B. Adams, that was arising out of the contract, was construed to cover any action that involves the same transaction and subject matter. And Roberts v. Adams was the case, along with Bedard v. Martin, that we primarily argued to the trial court because it explains why the trial court should and did award attorney fees in this case. Because the contract is the document by which Ms. Gaddis purchased the property. The contract relates, the purchase of the property obviously relates to the non-disclosure claim. Therefore, the action, and it doesn't even say claims. You know, it says any event of arbitration litigation. It doesn't even talk about claims. It just says, is this litigation relates to the contract? And it does, because the property was purchased by the contract. I really fail to see how one can argue that based upon prior case law that the trial court's decision was wrong. That gets you into this contextual argument. Matter of fact, I'd say Bedard v. Martin, they say it is apparent that the litigation arose from the contract for sale, although asserted under various theories, all of Bedard's claims against Mr. Martin arose from the sale of the property. And they could, that could have been written for this case. That's the exact same thing. I mean, those were tort claims that they're talking about in the Martin case. Just like here. It was the attorney fees were recovered under a contract clause, just like this one, because they arose out of the same sale of property. Now, I may not understand it correctly, but as I understand this contextual argument, this is how it goes. You look at the contract, section 20, and it says, times of the essence and remedies, times of the essence hereof, if any note or check received as earnest money hereunder or any other payments due hereunder is not paid, ignored, or tendered, honored or tendered when due, or if any other obligation hereunder is not performed as way as herein provided, there shall be the following remedies. Then it says, A, if buyer is in default and gives two specific performance liquidated damages. Then it says, B, if seller is in default. I think that's what the contract referring to when it's talking about remedies. Those are the remedies for if buyer is in default, if seller is in default. But then it throws in this additional paragraph in C and says costs and expenses. In the event of any arbitration or litigation relating to this contract, the arbitrator court shall award to the party prevailing all reasonable costs and expenses. Now, how what sellers do is they say, okay, well, we think that that you should construe this to have costs and expenses as part of the remedies under Section 20. That's how they get to this contextual argument to say, oh, therefore it has to be a breach of contract because Section 20 is talking about remedies, buyer's default, seller's default. But what it really is doing, it talks about the buyer's default, specific performance, liquidated damages, then it talks about seller's default, then it throws in a clause that's independent. I mean, it's a separate sentence. In the event of an arbitration litigation relating to this contract. Again, if the drafter's intent was to limit that to a breach of contract, they would say that. Or they wouldn't say relating to the contract, because they would know that relating to the contract, at least under prior case law, is a pretty broad term. And it's put in there for that very purpose, to make it broad, so that any action relating to the contract, you can recover attorney fees and costs. I don't know how it could be any clearer. And I know I haven't used up all my time, but I've used up all my words, and I thank you for your time and request that you affirm the trial court's award of attorney fees and costs and also award us attorney fees and costs for this appeal and the underlying appeal. Thank you.
Let me mention a few items in response to that. First of all, let me start with the case is cited in the brief, and within our briefing, we went through in great detail. All prevailing party provisions are not created equal. They need to be read based on what they specifically said. The cases relied on by the buyers in this case have some significant differences, and we point those out as we go through lines like notwithstanding this. And other situations also where the clauses are contained within the contracts in a way that's separate and is not subject to the limitations that occur in the present contract with the placement of this clause. I think it's important to note two things. If the intent of this clause was that it was not a part of this particular section of the contract, if it had nothing to do with buyer default and seller default, the easiest thing to do would be to not have it be subsection C. It would be paragraph 21. And stand on its own accord. I think its placement as one of three equal subsections in this particular aspect of the contract is notable. The other thing I would note is, yes, you have to read all of the language that is there. And if you look at, again, the inception of that paragraph, it talks about the remedies that shall be available, and they are these. And I think looking at the contract fairly, it is a more precise and more accurate reading to look at sections A, B, and C, under that subheading, rather than as section A and B modified by that subheading, but subsection C, which is just independent of that modification. I think that's a better reading of the contract, and a reading is more consistent with the applicable law, which does go into great detail in specific language in each clause and where it sits with respect to other contract language. And again, we would ask that the court reverse the attorney's fee award and in addition not award attorney's fees for this appeal. I would also be remiss in my duty if I did not mention one item that came up in the earlier argument. There was a finding in this case that my clients were not construction professionals. And that occurs in the judge's order on the motion to dismiss or stay pursuant to CRS 30-20-803.5. So I know that was in the merit section, but that topic having coming up, I thought it was important to note that section of the record for the court's consideration. For those reasons, again, we would ask that the attorney fee award be reversed in this case, along with a reversal on the merits. And thank you.
Well, we appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused, and in light of the cancellation of our second case, I think bails may not resist.